Everyone, you're tuning in once again to Deeper Groove, Musicians on Music, hosted by Cliff Beats and sponsored by California Soul Music Record Label. I get the pleasure of talking with LA's own Miles Mosley, an amazing bassist who has a great single, Brother, out right now and has done an amazing album. He's toured with Kamasi Washington. So excited to be able to hear from him today. Please help me welcome Miles Mosley. Hello, Miles. How are you? This is Cliff Beats calling from Deeper Groove.
Hey, what's up?
How are you?
Good, man. Just getting the old day up and running on its feet. What's going on with you?
Same for me. Hitting the ground running as always, but super excited to talk about you. Been listening to all your stuff over the weekend just to catch myself up on your illustrious bio. I mean, I've been a fan and watching you since I opened for you years ago at the Piano Bar, which is no longer there. But sounds like you have
a lot of... I walked by there the other day. It's crazy to see the whole hotel replacement of something that was like, well, I guess it wouldn't have been there now, but it was good while it lasted.
Oh, yeah. There's so many venues. I've been in L.A. since 2003, and so many venues have changed or are no more now.
Yeah. Where are you from?
I'm originally from Washington, D.C., Maryland area.
Oh, okay. Nice. They got good clubs out there, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah, 930 Club, if you've ever been there, that's amazing.
Yeah, I think I played there one time.
Oh, yeah, we used to go see all of our go-go concerts down there, a style that I wish was more everywhere else.
Well, I think that's one of those styles that only a few people know how dope it is, and somebody's going to grab it and, you know, get a pop hit, and all of a sudden, DC Go-Go is going to be really popular. But... you know, it's just not, the spotlight's not on it at the moment. But that's, I think, by far one of the dopest drum grooves on the planet.
Oh, yeah. As far as party music goes, I mean, it's just like
get out of here.
A constant barrage of batteria.
Yeah, it's so unique, and nothing else feels like that. Nothing else feels like it. It's its own language.
Exactly. And playing the keyboard is what I call the same as playing the triangle in an orchestra. You have so much rest. You hit like a couple stabs.
Yeah, right? That's the easiest gig in DC Go-Go?
Exactly. So you're originally from the Hollywood area, correct? So you're born and raised in L.A.
Yeah, born and raised in Los Angeles. Moved around a little bit within the city just for school and stuff. So I've lived in Westwood and Inglewood and Culver City and Hollywood and Venice. You know, I've lived around all the hot spots of LA my entire life.
Well, I mean, there's no kind of better place for the music and especially the music industry than LA. It's really one of the top three main hubs besides New York and Nashville and maybe Austin for live music.
Yeah, well, the coolest part about LA is that you're kind of in one of the main and most diverse factories of music industry. In Nashville, obviously, is where you go if you want to really learn how to write a song. But production is not the strong suit of Nashville. And New York has a lot of the production, great songwriting, but you don't have the multimedia side of it as much. Or at least, you know, you didn't. Everything's kind of global now, but growing up in L.A., when things were pretty segregated by city as far as jobs go, L.A. was one of the places where you could get experience composing for film, playing on a score in a film, writing, you know, hit songs, writing niche songs, playing on niche music, playing on, you know, top 10 records, and all of that stuff kind of, in order to succeed, you had to be good at all of it, across all genres, quickly, efficiently, and have a true respect for all styles of music and not just like a flaccid, sort of vain facade of caring. You had to really get in there and go, okay, I'm going to truly understand how death metal works, and I'm going to understand how Western classical music works. I'm going to get a really good, strong grip on jazz and a strong grip on you know, whatever was popular in rock grunge, say, in the 90s. You'd really get in there and understand it if you want to make a living. I think that separates growing up in L.A. from maybe being in other cities.
And were your parents musicians too? How did you get into music? I know that you're named Miles after Miles Davis, so how did that all come to be?
My parents don't play musical instruments. My father had a couple of brothers that were into music, but I was young when they passed away, and so they didn't have a direct influence on me in that respect. My parents were big music fans and had a great collection of music at home for me to listen to, and were big jazz fans, and obviously because of Miles Davis as a namesake, that stands to reason. I got into music kind of on accident. I wanted to learn how to draw comic books. And there, you know, when I was in junior high school, so I'm like 13, I'm really into comics and I want to learn how to draw. And they offered a drawing class. And so I signed up for it, but not enough kids showed interest. And so, cause it was a public school, if there's not enough kids, they can't afford to hire the teacher. Right. So they said, anybody who wants to draw, you got to pick between art history or orchestra. And I'm like, well, the point of me going to this class was not to take a test. The point of me taking this class was to have fun and learn something, you know, creative and something that would be easy. Like, if I didn't do a good job, I'd still get a B for trying, you know. So I decided to go to the orchestra, and I didn't know what any of the instruments sounded like or how to play them or anything. And so the teacher, her name was Miss West, all the other kids knew exactly what they wanted to play, actually. Because they wanted to go to orchestra. I didn't. I wanted to draw Wolverine. So I asked the teacher to play all the instruments for me, and she was like, not a great violin player. But she tried to play it anyway, and she was screeching and hemming and hawing, and I was like, dude, if I bring this home, my mom's going to be so mad at me trying to practice this thing. And at 13, knowing the difference between violin and viola is negligible. So I was like, no, that's not going to work. So she picks up the cello, and Miss West, she did play cello, and she played it really well. And she went into this etude, and it was gorgeous. I was like, that's what I want to do. That's my instrument. And she was like, cool, so I'm going to assign you a cello, and you'll take it home with you. And I was like, take it home? And I was living in Inglewood at the time, a fair distance away from school, so I had to take the bus. And, you know, kids are punks, and they tease each other, and you know, steal your lunch and starter jackets. It was tough. And I was like, Miss West, if you give me that cello, I might make it home and back 3 times tops before that thing's broken, stolen, or, you know, in some state of disrepair. And I looked in the corner and I saw, like, the scroll of this instrument sticking up out of the top of a locker. And I was like, what's that? She's like, oh, that's the upright bass. I was like, dang, you got to take that thing home? She's like, no, if you play upright bass, it stays here. You just come and practice it as much as you can. I was like, that's what I'm talking about. You've got yourself one upright bass player out of pure laziness and fear of, you know, the kids you run into on the way home. And I picked it up, and I played an A. And I remember, you know, I didn't really know how to hold it, so I was kind of clutching it next to my body. And it just resonated with me immediately. And, you know, over the next few months of playing it, realizing that all of the initial perception of music comes from the bottom up and how much control I had over this massive orchestra. Like, if I changed the note, the whole thing was different.
Mm-hmm.
And if everyone was playing a big, long C major chord and I started playing a rhythm on an A, it became this moving A minor chord, and there was nothing anybody could do about it. And that sense of power for a 13-year-old kid was like, you know, Spider-Man learning that he could run and jump and swing across buildings. I was having a field day. I dismantled so many classical pieces by the time I was 16. I knew it was something that I was going to really gravitate towards. And also, I was good at a lot of the more difficult roadblocks. So I wasn't discouraged very often along the way because I had pretty good hand strength and my dexterity and intonation and speed and, like, a lot of vibrato. These things kind of came naturally, and I had really good teachers. My parents got me private study with David Young from the L.A. Chamber Orchestra and John Clayton. And so I didn't have a lot of the disappointing roadblocks that some people have to, like, grind through that make you either level off or make it not fun. So I got really lucky. I was truly kind of built for it.
Yeah, it sounds really lucky too. And I can see your evolution from classical to jazz, trying to change the bass notes and reharm. That's a very jazz approach to music. So very, very cool. I wanted to get into your latest single, Brother, that came out at the end of last year. It's described as funky and displaying triumphant vocals and an innovative bass solo. So what was your process in creating this single, especially after your last debut album?
Well, Brother was a kind of flagship song for me. Every step of the way while making an album that to be called Chaotica, every step of the way, that song was kind of the one that let me know we were moving in the right direction. And so I had written it in a way that I'd never written any other song, which was sort of a meditation. Like I would write, wake up in the morning and I'd write, play a chord on the piano. I'd write it down. And then I wouldn't think about it at all. I'd go on about my day. And the next day I'd wake up, I'd go to the piano, I'd play the chord from the previous day and a new chord and write that down. And I would repeat that process every day. So on the fifth day, I would come to the piano, play five chords from the previous 5 days, and then add a sixth chord. And I did that for a month. And if you kind of go through Brother, it's roughly 28 or 30 chords. They're not necessarily always, a chord that hadn't been played before, but it's just what naturally came out of me for the spirit of that day. And the investigation there was, and this is before any lyrics had been written, was that oftentimes a song is like Polaroid, in which you're just capturing a moment, you're capturing an emotion, you're zooming in on an emotion, or you're zooming out on something, but it's you're seizing something, seizing a piece of inspiration. And I wondered what would happen if you continued to do that, continued to instill inspiration into a piece of music through the entirety of its writing process, so that just because I may be feeling good today, it doesn't rob the song of the ability to express how I feel 4 days from now, which might be really crappy. So I wondered if that would make a difference. So I did that, and I kind of had these chords, and it started to develop the lyric, which came from this hold the line idea that you just kind of have to stick with it. And so this song that is kind of me sticking with it for a month, that was sort of the theme, and then translating that into how we climb through our lives. And that sometimes the only thing to do is to just bear with it, and in that you will find your options and your choices. And so I write the lyric, and I'm really happy with the lyric. It's got kind of a Marvin vibe to it. It's got a little bit of a Curtis Mayfield vibe to it. So I'm happy with the lyric at that point. But the song stops at Hold the Line. And so it's time to make the record. I bring it in, and I play the song for Tony. I play the demo for Tony Austin, who's the producer and drummer for the West Coast Get Down, and he produces this record for me. And we're in rehearsal with the full band, and we're getting these songs ready to go into the studio in the next couple of days. And I think the song sounds great. We've got the groove. It's cool. Like we're cruising. So we break the band for the day, and we're leaving, and Tony's sitting on the couch, and he's like, man, that song's not done. It's good, but it's not great. It's like, you're telling me to hold the line, telling me to hold on for what? Yes, you can amp somebody up and say, tell them to weather the storm. But why? Like, at a certain point in time, you've been beaten so much. You've climbed through so many adversities. Why would I hold on? Why not just give up and try a different way? He's like, you're sounding this big battle cry, but you're never telling us what happens when we win the war. Or, for what purpose are we going to move forward? He's like, you're missing the song. You're missing a part of the song. It's not done. So, one of the great reasons you work with a producer is because they tell you what it is, how it is, and they don't sugarcoat things. And, telling somebody that their favorite song is not done is something that probably only Tony Austin could do to me. Tony and Barbara, probably. So I go home, and I'm all pissed off. Like, this song is perfect. What are you talking about? But I sit at the piano, and I buy into my own mantra that, well, if this song is not finished, then the only thing to do is to stick with it and hunker down and sit in front of it. And I'm playing it over and over and over again. I'm saying, well, you're holding on to what and for why. And it dawns on me that phrase, built to survive. You know, well, maybe it's possible that someone's purpose in life could be to come out on the other side of hard times or torturous times, or like the hills over a shore where waves are crashing up against them all the time. It has to be there. You need those cliffs, or else the land is going to be washed away by the sea. So you need something to just sit there and take a beating. That's your purpose. That's what you're here for.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote the Built to Survive part and brought it into Tony, and he was like, now we have a song. And once we tracked that song for the first time, I thought, now I have a record. And every time something would get added to that song or it would get across the finish line, it was this confirmation, like, this is something important and something special, and it really represents the peak of my writing ability at the moment, at the current state.
That's great. I mean, that's great to see such a triumphant sophomore album, sophomore meaning, after your first uprising that you did for Universal and Verve label group. And so that was very exciting. Your last album, you signed a multi-album deal with them. The first single, Abraham, named one of NPR's top 100 songs of 2016. Got critical acclaim from tons of publications. LA Times, Rolling Stone said you were one of the top new artists you should know. The single received worldwide radio airplay, BBC Radio, Apple Beats, debuting at number 4 on the Billboard Contemporary Jazz Chart, 10 on the Jazz Album Chart, and 2 on iTunes Jazz Album Chart. And so you had a sold-out world tour, which we watched from your website and everywhere, going through Europe and everywhere else. How did it feel to achieve that level of success in music, which is no easy feat?
Yeah, it definitely is no easy feat, and it's not something it's funny, you oftentimes get so lost in the doing of it that you rarely get a chance to look at the highlight reel, you know, because you're getting ready for the next game. But it's something that I don't take lightly, and I know that there are a lot of amazing musicians and artists that don't get the opportunities that we had to work for and get lucky to have. And, you know, we sat, Los Angeles as a whole, in a lot of ways, sat outside the spotlight for a while, and each city kind of gets its own turn. And fortunately, you know, we were all sharpening our swords and waiting for our turn, and when LA kind of got put back on into the limelight, we were ready to roll and had records made and shows up and running and material to capitalize on the opportunity. But it feels fantastic. I mean, this is the only thing I know how to do, really. I've devoted my entire life to it. I've devoted my life to the bass and to changing what it sounds like and trying to propel it into the 21st century and update it to where, you know, I see all the other instruments have gotten, and still maintain its integrity and its attachment to all the amazing bass players that came before me, and then also as a songwriter to grow and say something that I don't know that I necessarily heard growing up, or at least to be the type of artist that I wanted to have in my life as I was coming up. So I think the goals the micro goals are constantly changing, but the larger goals are always in place, and that's to be a vessel for the muse and a vessel for inspiration, try to be a sort of shine your light on the world and help out best you can before you get out of here.
Oh, yeah, I think that's definitely a good way to live your life and definitely shine that light. So speaking of adding that light to the musical community, you've worked with so many greats, from Kamasi Washington to NDRE, Chris Cornell, Avenged Sevenfold, Jonathan Davis from Korn. You produced a record for Terrence Howard, which I didn't even know he made records. Everlast, Kenny Loggins, Andre Day, Kendrick Lamar, I mean, Pimp a Butterfly. You can go on with that. And then does any one record stick out to you in your mind?
Well, I think I'm immensely grateful for what the To Pimp a Butterfly record did for Los Angeles and the boost it gave to all the dope artists that are in the clique out here, Thundercat and Terrace Martin and Kamasi, and, you know, it really cracked open the scene for us to all be able to have a chance to share with the world what we had been kind of working on in the shadows. But one of my favorite experiences was making that Chris Cornell record, because I grew up as a huge grunge fan, and Soundgarden and Temple of the Dog, and, you know, those were staple artists, and those Chris Cornell records stuck with me and kind of defined this grit and majesty. And to be able to play bass on a Chris Cornell record and hear this guy, like, he can write 3 songs a day without cracking a sweat. And every take is record ready. He's not missing notes along the way. He's not like, oh, let me learn that better. It's kind of distracting to be around a legend like that, such a quintessential voice, something that has defined a genre of singing. It can be hard to focus, but he was really kind to me, and we talked a lot about him coming up in Seattle and what it was like to share the opportunities from one band to the other during this time when grunge was exploding and record labels knew that there was money to be made off of these artists, but didn't necessarily know how to find them or didn't really know or care about the music. And so, you know, the way that you get from Alice in Chains to Pearl Jam to, you know, Jane's Addiction to Soundgarden, they're friends, and they're telling their labels, like, if you think we're dope, you should go check out Ned's Atomic Dustbin. And then all of a sudden, you know, the community as a whole gets put on and everything is better. And I think I learned that lesson mainly from my time talking to Chris and just asking him how it happened. And we were able to practice that with the West Coast Get Down, sort of sharing the opportunities and making sure that, or at least trying to ensure that when one person has an opportunity, someone else in the clique gains something from it as well. And if you constantly share things, it's hard for any one person to lose it all, because you've given some of it for safekeeping to the people that you trust and love. And that stuck with me for a long time.
Well, yeah, I mean, I definitely agree too that we're stronger together, better together. And, you know, you don't want to make it to the top and have no one around. You want to have your friends and your homies around, especially your musical community. And I think that's great that you're building something, and I think that's great that LA is getting the shine that it has deserved for many years, and has a spotlight now with the West Coast Collective, Get Down. And so is there any artist that you haven't worked with yet that if you were given the chance you would love to work with?
Oh, man, there are so many. I really like what Moses Sumney is doing. Big Anderson .Paak fan.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, that's the last song he did with Andrew Day, Lockdown song. That was really good.
Really, really good.
Yep. Brittany Howard is dope. I think she's a tremendous singer. I'd like to work more with, you know, cats like Christian Scott and Glasper and those dudes.
I think the more
things kind of cross-collaborate, the better. Nubia is dope out of London as the saxophone player. She's killer. She's managed by SBMM, my management team, and she's super dope. She just put out a new record too. I'd like to see in general the London scene and the LA scene mesh together, because I think there's a lot of the same attitudes and magnetisms or even like safeguards up between the two. And I think it's crucial for artists to recognize when people are defining encampments and kind of separating us, like, oh, well, there's New York jazz, there's LA jazz, there's London jazz, and those things aren't the same. As soon as you hear something like that, you should all get in a room together, because that's not true. And that's counterproductive to go, you know, we've lived through versions of that, and they never work. East Coast hip-hop, West Coast hip-hop. It's like, Yeah, there are sonic differences, of course. But healthy competition is important. To box one another out is dangerous, I think, for the art form, for the longevity of the art form. Who else would I like to work with? There are so many. Bon Iver, I really like him.
Oh, yeah.
He's a fantastic songwriter. Francis the Lights, great songwriter. I really like Phoebe Bridgers. I think she's a fantastic lyricist and songwriter. Yeah, there's lots of stuff. I wish I could bring some people back from the dead, too, but, you work with what you get.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that would open even a much bigger list.
Yeah, right.
You could do that. And so then, what would be your advice you would give a young musician starting out now in music?
I think my main advice would be to understand that music is something between you and the heavens. Like, it's learning to make music, play an instrument. That's a beautiful thing, and you should do it. And you should, I think everybody should learn how to play something. And making it will bring you so much joy. It'll brighten you up when you're down. It'll co-sign on different emotions that you have. It's a great tool for your soul. But doing that is different from a career in the music business. And it is okay to learn how to make music and not try and make money off of it. That's okay. You can have something you do for money, something you do for music. But if you are going to try to make money off of music, understand that equal to studying theory and, let's say you want to play guitar, taking your guitar lessons, equal to that, you need to study economics, because what you're doing is starting a business. And that business is going to have to take a very small bit of income and stretch it out for long periods of time. And in addition to that, if you can learn how to take a little bit of money that you make from, say, a gig or from a recording contract or a publishing deal or whatever, if you can take a little bit of that money and make it into, with wise investments and an understanding of fundamental economics, make it into more money, then you'll never have to sacrifice the joy of making music for the necessity of making money. And you will be so much happier for that. So it takes time to understand economics, and it can be boring, but if you want to make money off of music, that is what you're doing. You are starting a business, and that business requires you to have a fundamental understanding of how money works.
Yes, I agree, and I think that's a travesty that school doesn't teach us about financial literacy. It most certainly should, and it doesn't, and I think that's a lot of people are screaming for that type of reform, and I agree. Wholeheartedly what you're saying about people as musicians, they don't come and tell you that you are a business, you are a entrepreneur, you are a business of one, and people, if you're hiring other musicians, you're creating jobs and opportunities for them. And so there is a lot of economics and business that you'll either learn or get taken advantage of. And a lot of artists, unfortunately, do from bad deals and trusting the wrong people and things like that. I mean, you really do have to keep an eye on the money, especially because it's so up and down. You really have to be able to know how to save and invest in the fat years for the lean years, which are coming.
Right, and I think since this question is angled towards a young person, when you are your youngest, you kind of think of music like it's a home run derby. Like, I'm going to go out there, and when the pitch comes across the plate, I'm going to hit the ball, and I'm a genius, and I'm going to make it, and it's going to be a home run, and I'm going to have a bunch of money, and off we go. And that's possible. Certainly there are plenty of evidence of that happening. But it's also possible that you're going to get up there and hit a little line drive and, just make it around a couple bases, using that analogy to say that we oftentimes think of music and money as in these massive windfalls, and it actually can come in a lot smaller pieces, and you just have to know how to work it. It'll just make it so much more enjoyable of an experience if you don't have to constantly sacrifice your integrity to make money, the integrity of your music to make money in the business. And there are so many different ways. You know, you don't have to be the lead singer of a band to make money in music. You can play in that band. You can write music for that band. You can sync music for that band. There's so many different ways to be involved with it, which is why it's really important to draw a line between I make music because it makes me happy and I make music because it makes me money. And those are two different bites. Just know that going into it and know that it's okay to learn how to play enough guitar to be a hit at parties with friends and be a really fun person to go camping with. And you don't have to bank your whole life off of it. You know, it's not, you don't have to, but if you want to, just know what you're getting into.
Excellent. Well said. Well said. My final question for you is, what is your legacy? What do you want to be most remembered for musically? And I know that you have a new album coming out, hopefully in the next year, Chaotica. And so what do you want to be known for the most?
That may change as I grow older, but I have a hunch that bringing the upright bass into the 21st century is probably what I will be most known for. Being one of the pioneers of showing the multitudes of that instrument and how many different lanes it can fit in, how many different sounds can be pulled from it, and how big and enormous that instrument can be. And if I can leave a legacy in which somebody thinks of upright bass and thinks of upright bass solos and attaches those to sort of aggression and larger than life sounds and the ability to really cry and like a full spectrum of sound and not just relegated to the back of a band, you know, holding down the low end. If I can do that, then I think I've accomplished what I was sent here to accomplish.
I agree. And seeing you play, I mean, I can say as a musician, I enjoy watching you, the energy that you put out there, how you work with the band, you know, the notes you play, the notes you don't play. I mean, you play whole notes in some ways, like, you know, better than just a virtuosic solo, since you do both. But the confidence behind it, the way you actually hit the notes and the attack, it's just, it comes across very differently. And when you're singing too, I mean, it's very jubilant and you know, singles like Abraham, I mean, they just really resonate, and that bass resonance just kind of hits you in a certain way. You feel it all over the room.
Yeah, so I think you'll definitely always grown up reading, you know, my first book my mom ever gave me to read was the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And I don't come from a religious background, but I do come from a spiritual one. And reading the great tomes and the great texts has always been a pastime of mine. And I think what I'm most fascinated by is the sense of permanence of each one. Like, you read the Tao and it sounds, I don't care what language you put it in, it just sounds permanent. It sounds like these ideas are not going anywhere. And that is, from this point forward, these things are, if not truths, because that's dependent to each person, they are undeniably stated. You know, what's in the Bible has been stated. What's in the Quran has been stated. And you can feel the weight of these things in the Old Testament or in the Tao or in the, you know, we all share this knowledge over hundreds and sometimes thousands of years. So to make a statement on the upright bass that is forever and unshaking, and to hopefully write some songs in which the lyrics contain the weight of timelessness is always my goal.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a way, a great way to really put it. And the verbiage, I like what you said a lot about how, you know, these classic timeless things have been written. They really miss what they said, and they don't mince words. You know, they don't add any fluff or anything. They just, it is what it is, and it's raw and it's honest, and it's well said.
Yeah, totally.
Well, thank you so much, Miles, for being on the podcast today. We'll definitely circle back to you and your team when it's out so we can give you links and everyone can listen to it. But I really enjoyed it just as a musician and a fan. And I love looking at your career and seeing more that you're doing and going to your website and seeing more shows. So we're all hoping that 2020 is different, where we can get back on the road again and do other stuff.
Yeah.
But there's tons of stuff that we can do still online and to connect with people. But looking forward to this new album. It sounds amazing. If anything, you know, the Brother single as a lead-in is kind of showing what that album is going to be. Then I know it's going to be really, really amazing.
Yeah, I appreciate that, man. Thanks for taking the time to talk to me. And I'm sure we'll see each other on the road next year sometime. And yeah, like you said, the community banding together to think of new creative ways to bridge the gap between live music and online music is something we can all work forward to. And these podcasts are a good example of a good start. So I'm happy to be on it. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you, sir. We'll be talking soon. Take care.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks again for listening to Deeper Groove, Musicians on Music, hosted by Cliff Beach and sponsored by California Soul Music Record Label. I had the pleasure of talking with LA's own Miles Mosley, an amazing bassist, amazing musician, about his single Brother, his last album, and his work with Kamasi Washington. I hope you guys enjoyed it. Go check out his stuff on Spotify and all streaming platforms today. I'd also like to thank our engineer, Tim Hall, for mastering and mixing this recording today. If you like what you hear and you want to hear more, you can check us out online at www.californiasoulmusic.com/deepergrooves or anchor.fm/deepergrooves. Until then, keep it snazzy, keep it jazzy. We'll talk to you soon.